Welcome everyone for joining us today for our discussion. I am Marina Kurkcan, a fellow of the Center for Sociolegal Studies at Wilson College, and today I also represent the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society. This is three institutions that are sponsoring this event today. It's a great honor for me to chair this panel with distinguished experts on matter of law and politics of the European Union. And we ask them to address issues. What would happen if Scotland gained independence? So this discussion is not about yes or no campaign, but rather about new situation that European Union has to face if part of the country, which is one of the main funding country of the European Union, decide to go independent. How constitutionally this issue is resolved? What's the framework of legal and political to embrace this new development? We do know that other countries like Spain, I suspect some Central European countries, are very closely watching what's happening and all the debate that's going around this. This is a very hot issue, and we hear very different voices, mostly politically charged. When the Westminster telling us that Scotland will go and stand in the long queue behind Montenegro and Serbia. From Scotland, we have been told that no, we have all institutions, it's a matter of a couple of months, just to be part, nothing changing much. But they are politically charged, and therefore we have experts today on this issue, which will consider from different disciplines what's the real prospect, what's the real issue, and what could be discussed after. So we asked our panelists to address three questions, broadly speaking, which are what would be the terms of membership, and would Scotland meet these terms if it gets independence and apply for European Union? There is also a question, would Scotland want to do that? With all these negative anti-European sentiments that run so high, is there really great benefit nowadays and Scotland would want to do that? And what would be consequences for the European Union and other countries? And our distinguished and very knowledgeable on this issue panel consists of Michael Keating, Professor of Scottish Politics at the University of Aberdeen and Edinburgh, who is also Director of the Scottish Centre for Constitutional Change, which is a consortium of teams from five institutions which put together to examine issues arising from the debate on Scottish Constitution. Mr. Graham Avery, Senior Advisor at the European Policy Centre in Brussels and Honorary Director General of the European Commission and also Senior Member of St. Anthony's College here in Oxford. And my colleague from the Faculty of Law, Sinead Douglas-Scott, who is Professor of European and Human Rights Law. And now I'll give the floor to Michael Keating to share with us his views.
Well, thanks, Marina. Thanks to the Centre for the...
Just complete that. I'll ask you to speak for 15, 20 minutes, yeah. Which then will leave time to all of us to participate in the
debate. Yeah. Okay, I've been talking about this consistently about 23 hours a day for the last 6 months, so I'll try to keep my time limit here. So it's great to be back in Oxford, a place where I've spent various parts of my career dating back to the 1960s, and indeed I visited this college, I think, a few years ago, very briefly. What I'm proposing to do is give an overview of this whole question of the relationship of Scotland to Europe as a result of quite a long period of reflection, because almost exactly 40 years ago, it occurred to me that it might be interesting to look at the relationship between the Scottish debate, which was pretty live in 1974, because
we had two elections and the nationalists were doing extremely well, that and the process of European
integration, because they seem to be complementary rather than contradictory processes. They're to do with the rescaling of political authority, the hollowing out of the state, and new levels of government coming in. So I went to St Andrew's House, I talked to the Scottish Government civil servants. They thought it was a rather interesting idea, but nobody else did, and I didn't get any money to do it. But a few years later, my Welsh colleague Barry Jones and I put together a collection about regions and stateless nations in the European community, as it then was. And we got a certain amount of interest in this idea that there's a complementarity between devolution downwards and getting power upwards, and there's really something to be worked on. And we got a book out of that from Oxford, as it happens. And then 10 years after that, in 1995, we did a second book covering all the then countries of what was becoming the European Union. I think there was maybe 12 countries at that point, and a great deal of interest. So the thing started to take off, and this was reflected back into Scotland again. Now, when the issue of membership of the European communities was being debated in Scotland in the 1960s and 1970s, Scotland was somewhat hostile, and the Scottish nationalists were particularly hostile, because Brussels was seen as being even more remote than London. We're losing power already, we're at the periphery, we are going to be the losers from this process. And there is a contradiction between asking for self-government and then subordinating yourself to a supranational authority. And in 1975, in the referendum, Scotland voted yes, but by a less convincing majority than the rest of the United Kingdom, lower than England and lower than Wales. But by the 1990s, this has started to change, because this idea that there's something in common between these two processes had been pretty well established. And it was exactly in 1988, which is the same time as the Labour Party, that the SNP changed its position on Europe and adopted the slogan of independence in Europe, partly as a result of the influence of Jim Siller, as a former Labour MP who'd gone through this process, joined the SNP and persuaded that supporting Europe would be a good thing. But it should say there is an even earlier tradition in Scottish nationalism back into the 1930s that's quite pro-European. This was happening in other places as well. Spain with the transition to democracy, the Basque country and Catalonia gaining self-government. Europe was seen as an essential framework for their project, as well as the project of Spanish democratization. And during the 1980s and 90s, there were a number of concepts out there as to how these things could be linked up. For a while, people talked about the Europe of the regions, which was never a terribly well-defined idea. And Barry Jones and I, having published these two books about it, used to go around telling people, don't get too excited about it. It's not, the state is not going to disappear in favor of the regions, and regional policy is not the same as regional government, trying to clarify things. But there was a great deal of excitement, particularly when the structural funds came in and people saw these, what would now be euro signs in front of their eyes, and politicians thought they could go to Brussels and get pots of money and bring it back home, which they couldn't, but they claimed they were doing that anyway. So there was this very vague debate about Europe of the regions, and nationalist movements latched onto that, saying, well, we can be part of this. That is a way of getting us directly into the European framework. And then some nationalist movements went beyond that and towards what late Neil McCormick called post-sovereignty, a term which I myself have also used. Well, once we've got Europe, the old nation state is going away anyway, it's disappearing. We can be self-governing, but not in the form of a sovereign state, because that's really old-fashioned. And this allowed some nationalist movements to outflank their nation states by saying, you're the old-fashioned nationalists, we're the post-sovereigntists or the and the cosmopolitans. And that is still a very important theme in Scotland. Scotland, or the SNP, didn't go down that post-sovereignty route because they say, we're going to have our own state. But they did accept that this would be within the European Union, which clearly is a way of attenuating sovereignty. It's not sovereignty in the classic sense, and the Scottish nationalists are admitting that it's not. But it's become an essential support system, an external support system for an independent Scotland, because since then, almost nobody has talked about Scotland outside the European Union as being a viable possibility. And this is why I get a little bit puzzled by the unionists suddenly discovering that the SNP want Europe as well, because that's clearly been, when the Edinburgh Agreement was signed, that was the deal. It was independence in Europe. Nobody was supporting anything else. So the two are very, very closely linked. Now, if we look at public opinion in Scotland, there's a certain conceit on the part of Scottish politicians that we're terribly pro-European and we're all kinds of other things. Public opinion in Scotland is slightly less Eurosceptic than it is in England, which is not saying very much because it's pretty Eurosceptic here. But there's not this obsession about Europe in Scotland. It's not a deeply felt issue. It's not something that people really can get engaged about. So there's no political mileage in playing against Europe in Scotland because people are not really interested in that. And if you go to the institutional level, the elites, we might call them in Scotland, civil society, there's pretty much unanimity in favour of Europe. And I tell my Spanish colleagues when they come and visit there, go around and count the number of European flags you see in Edinburgh. Actually, there are numerous. And then go to London and count the number of European flags, and I'll give you £5 for everyone that you see there. So there's this banal pro-Europeanism, because there's a pro-European consensus. And there's not a lot of competition on the Eurosceptic front because the Conservative Party are very weak and not particularly Eurosceptic. And because UKIP this is one of the places that UKIP is weak. It's weak in London, it's weak in Scotland. They won one seat in the European election because there was a split on the pro-European parties for the sixth seat. So they snuck in with one seat. But they're getting 10% of the vote on a very good day. And they've never even saved a parliamentary or Scottish Parliament deposit at any election, by-election or general election. So there's no real question, there's no visible Euroscepticism in Scotland, and therefore everybody is competing to be pro-European. As a result of this, when Alex Salmond launched his white paper last November at a meeting of so-called stakeholders, which I was deemed to be one, so I was invited with our project, he got up and said, I want to say two things to begin with. We are pro-immigration, and we are pro-Europe. And I thought, well, you know, nobody, I turned to my neighbours and said, you couldn't say that in England. But everybody here said, sure, you know, that's not contentious. Nobody's going to get upset about that. So that is an important part of the context of all of this. saying, well, we definitely want to stay in Europe and we don't want to be taken out of Europe against our own will is something that plays reasonably well. Not because people love Europe, they don't love it anyway, but because they see it as something that is necessary, that is important, and it's part of our constitution, and nobody's going to get worked up about the idea of withdrawing. Indeed, to the point that opinion polls that have been taken recently on British withdrawal, the last ones have shown that most people in the UK would just vote to stay in. But last year, they were showing a majority in England to come out and a majority in Scotland to stay in, which is the kind of thing that political scientists are fascinated with. I wish it would happen, because that would be a wonderful experiment for us to see what would happen under those circumstances. Now, Graham and I have talked about the division of Labour here, and he's going to talk about whether, if Scotland became independent, it would become a member of the European Union. I agree with everything that he's written about this, and he's written quite a bit, so I don't intend to repeat that. I do think that Scotland would be a member of the European Union. There are a lot of questions about the terms upon which Scotland will want to be a member of the European Union, or could be a member of the European Union. And one of the questions was, well, would Scotland want to be a member of the European Union? I think the answer to that is quite clearly yes. I think you'd find it difficult to find a member of the Scottish Parliament who, including Conservatives, who would actually want to pull out of the European Union. There are all sorts of nitpicking questions by people trying to invent reasons why Scotland would not be allowed in. Frankly, I think this is a way of just reconducting a debate that one side has already lost, because they started off by saying Scotland couldn't become independent. They lost that argument, we're going to have a referendum, but you won't be allowed in the European Union. It's just the same argument, because nobody's ever proposed being independent outside the European Union. So a lot of it is just sheer politics. And then there are a lot of questions about the opt-out and so on. But I will just finish by talking about what Scotland might do within the European Union, because it strikes me that the prospectus offered by the SNP is not too ambitious, but it's somewhat lacking in ambition, because they say they want to tone down the meaning of independence, not just by accepting membership of the European Union, but by accepting a currency union with the United Kingdom. We could perhaps talk about this later on, it's a very contentious theme. Which would lock them into the UK for monetary policy and in a fiscal pact with the UK, lock them into UK financial regulation in all kinds of ways, and therefore detach them from the developments that are going on in Europe at the moment, which are all about financial regulation, banking union, and so on. So we would stay with the rest of the United Kingdom and not go along with Europe. And then it's proposed to accept all the existing British opt-outs, including Justice and Home Affairs. And the official position of the Scottish National Party on this opt-out, when the decision was taken last year, was the SNP didn't want to opt out of Justice and Home Affairs, because they're good Europeans. But now they say, oh, we will, as an independent country, will actually opt out, because we've got to stick with the United Kingdom because of the common travel area and all kinds of things like that. And then what we haven't really had is a debate about what kind of Europe we want in Scotland. The debate between the intergovernmental, nobody talks about supranationalism anymore, but the community method versus the intergovernmental method, a stronger Europe, an integrating Europe, a disintegrating Europe, a social Europe, a market Europe, or so on. These are all big choices which a country about to become a member of the European Union really has to take, and instead of which there's the argument, well, we'll just have it on the same terms as the United Kingdom. But the United Kingdom is gradually seeking to detach itself. Maybe we'll leave altogether, but the main parties seem to be moving to a position now that we don't want to leave, but we do want to pull halfway out of the European Union. And we can discuss whether that's possible. I'm very sceptical about it. David Cameron says Scotland can't withdraw halfway from the UK, it's one or the other, but the UK can have a halfway house. He thinks the Devo Max is possible in the European Union, but not the UK. But anyway, that's the position of the parties. This would put Scotland in a very difficult position, because if the UK is drifting away, Scotland would be pulled away with it, and this would undermine part of the purpose of being independent in Europe to begin with. And then there's a whole debate about what small countries can do in world markets and in the European Union. They don't have the weight of the big countries, but they can do things if they're organized in a smart way and they really understand their way around the European institutions. I've done a small book, which is, Graham has a copy here, about small nations in a big world that addresses that. We've got some flyers here. Which addresses that. What can small countries do? They can't behave like big countries, but they can do smart, clever things, and there are examples of European countries that are very successful at doing that. Now, that applies in the case of independence. How will Scotland fit into Europe? And if there's a decision to become independent, then about which I have to be neutral, contractually, it's written down. If there is that decision, then I would want Scotland to take a more positive role in Europe than the United Kingdom is taking, and many people would. And if there is a no vote, there's still a question of how Scotland fits into Europe, given that Scottish opinion may increasingly differ from opinion in Westminster about European policies and where Europe is going to go.
Thank you. Thank you. And now I'll ask Graham to continue the.
I'd like to begin by asking the audience a question about the referendum. I'm not going to ask you whether you're going to vote yes or no, that would be incorrect. But would you put up your hand if you will vote in Scotland on the 18th of September?
Depends on if I move up there and
pass. Okay, but there's one potential vote, but not on the minute.
Do you hear up there? Is the voice?
Can you be?
Okay. As Michael's said, today's discussion here is taking place against the background of two debates. They're both going on in the United Kingdom at the present time, and they're both linked to referendums. And I'd like to sort of clarify my own position on this. We know that a referendum will take place in Scotland on the 18th of September. We know that a referendum may take place in the United Kingdom in 2017 on the question of its membership of the European Union. Mr. Cameron has declared that if he and his party win the next election and form the government, they will renegotiate the terms of membership and have a referendum. Of course, it's possible that he won't win the next election, perhaps even probable that he won't win the next election, but whichever party wins the next election in this country will inherit an obligation to have a referendum on the European Union if there's any further transfer of power from London to Brussels. I don't think that's very probable in the next 10 years either, but that's another story. One of the results is that these two referendum debates are interlinked. I just want to touch on that to begin with. After all, one of the arguments of Mr. Salmon and the Scottish National Party is that the best way for Scotland to remain in the European Union is to leave the United Kingdom. This is quite worrying for those who want the United Kingdom to stay in the European Union, because if 5 million Scots left in 2016, it wouldn't be so easy to get a yes in the referendum in 2017. If Scotland remains in the United Kingdom, and there's a referendum in 2017, it's possible, I'm not predicting it, but it's possible that there would be a no to EU membership in England and a yes to EU membership in Scotland. And that situation, it seems to me, would provoke again the question of Scottish independence. Last but not least, I just want to underline that both these debates concern membership of unions. And so it's quite paradoxical. Some who argue in favour of Scotland remaining in the union with England, and the slogan is better together, some of the same people nevertheless insist that Britain should leave the European Union. Anyway, I want to make my own position on these two referendums clear. On the Scottish question, I'm neutral. I don't have a vote in Scotland, and even if I had a vote, to be honest, I'm not quite sure which way I would have cast it. On the European question, well, I'm in favour of Britain's continuing membership for a number of reasons, which I could explain at great length, but that's a topic for another seminar here. Should Britain remain in the European Union? Agreed?
Agreed.
Okay. Anyway, let me come back to Scotland. You might ask how someone like me got involved in the Scottish question. After all, I was born in Wales, I'm resident in England, I spent most of my working career abroad, and the reason is quite simple. When the debate began a couple of years ago about Scottish independence, when they decided to have the referendum, I realised that people I know and people I respect in London, politicians, commentators, journalists, were beginning to use a series of arguments, which seem to me, arguments about the European Union and Scotland, which just seem to me false. They built up this argument that the European Union is a huge obstacle to Scottish independence, and a huge handicap. I sometimes say they tried to use the European Union as a weapon of mass dissuasion in a way that seemed to me quite incorrect. For example, Scotland would have, first of all, to leave the European Union and then join a queue for membership with the countries you mentioned, if you forgot to mention Turkey and so on. And even the most recent member was Croatia. So one argument is you'd be out for 10 years. And again, there's the argument that Scotland would be obliged to join the Euro and the Schengen area and all that kind of thing. And my reaction to these arguments was and remains complete nonsense. It's absolute rubbish. And although I don't have a position in the Scottish campaign, I have sufficient respect for this democratic process to want to be able to put a more balanced set of facts in the public domain. So 2 years ago, I took up my pen. I wrote a memorandum for a committee of the House of Commons explaining why, in my opinion, Scotland wouldn't and shouldn't be forced to leave the European Union if it declares independence. After all, when I worked in Brussels, my professional expertise was in the enlargement of the European Union. I was one of the architects of the big enlargement of the European Union. And if there's one thing I know about, it's how to join the European Union. And this is the expertise I applied to Scotland. What's special about the Scottish case, the scenario we're examining, is simply that there is no historical precedent for it in the European Union. It would be the first time that a member state divided into two parts, and both parts wanted to remain in the European Union. It wouldn't be the first time that a part of a member state left the member state. That happened in the 1960s when Algeria left France. It happened in the 1980s when Greenland, first of all, left the European Union and then got independence from Denmark. But in both those historical precedents, the parties, the pieces that left, didn't want to remain in the European Union. Now, the EU treaty lays down a procedure where non-member states can join. That's Article 49. And there's a procedure for member states to leave if they want to do so. That's Article 50. But there's no procedure for transforming one member state into two member states. What the European Union treaty says in Article 48, it provides a general revision procedure which allows you to deal with other scenarios which you hadn't imagined. Now, there's a lively dispute among the lawyers about which of these articles, 48 or 49, should be used in the case of Scotland. But I'm not going to enter into the legal case. I'm sure Shona will say more about that. I simply want to say, with all due respect to the eminent lawyers here, that if the Scottish people say yes in September, the decision on how to proceed will be taken in the European Union, not by lawyers, but by the elected politicians, the heads of government, meeting at the summit in the European Council, and they'll take the decision, as they usually do, on the basis of political and practical considerations, and then they'll tell the lawyers to put it in good legal form. So I'm going to address the practical and political aspects of this question. First of all, from the political point of view, it seems to me quite absurd to suggest that 5 million Scots who've applied EU policies for 40 years under EU citizens should be told to leave or that they could never join. In this respect, the case of Scotland is quite different from non-member states like Turkey and Montenegro. But, of course, there are some EU member states, particularly Spain, which have serious political problems with Scottish independence. Personally, I don't think that means that Spain would veto Scotland joining. But, of course, we know, in addition, that there are 5 member states of the European Union who still have refused to recognise Kosovo's independence because that was a unilateral declaration. They don't want that to be the precedent in their own countries. Here again, the Scottish process is quite different. It's not a unilateral declaration. It's a consensual process approved under the British Constitution, which of course doesn't exist in written form. From the practical point of view, and this is the key argument in my opinion, there is no member state, none of the 28 member states of the European Union, have a material interest in Scotland being outside. Not even briefly, for a few days. For Scotland to be outside the European Union would deprive member states and their citizens and their firms of not only the right, but not only the benefits of Scottish membership. Scotland would be a net payer into the EU budget. Scotland has by far the biggest share of the maritime resources among EU states. But all EU citizens would lose their rights in Scotland. This would be a legal nightmare, which would no one has an interest in, at least of all London. So my argument is that the European Union would decide to find a procedure where Scottish independence could coincide with Scotland's membership of the European Union. Now, you might say, what about Mr. Barroso and Mr. Van Rompuy, who have both made statements, quite complicated statements, implying that that wouldn't be possible and that Scotland would have to follow the external route. How about Mr. Cameron, who's reported in the press today as saying, and you quoted him, Maria, that Scotland would have to join the queue behind the others. Well, first of all, as far as Mr. Barroso is concerned, now I must be a bit prudent here because I used to work for him. I mean, I've retired from the Commission, so I express my personal view now. But I think, you know, he gave this television interview a few months ago where he said Scotland's membership of the European Union could be very difficult. I could have agreed with him up to date. It's never difficult. It's never easy to join the European Union. And then he added three killer words, very difficult, if not impossible. And I think that was just not very serious. And believe me, other people in the Commission, when you asked them why he said it, you were met with an embarrassed silence. And I think he just went over the top. Mr. Cameron has said a similar thing today, and I know why he said it. It's that a couple of days ago, a report, quite a lengthy report, 20 pages, was published by Business for New Europe, a London-based business organisation. And the idea is that they're not new. They published a similar argument 2 years ago, and I've read their report very carefully, but what I find baffling in the report of Business for New Europe is they don't even address the material question, would it be in the interest of the United Kingdom and any other member state for Scotland to stay outside? So I think there's, I must be prudent here, there's a lot of rhetoric and taking positions in this and not a serious examination of the facts. One thing I learned in international affairs, as a negotiator in international affairs, is that you should, of course you should listen to what your interlocutor, the person you're negotiating, you should listen to what he or she has to say, but you should devote even more time to analysing his or her interests, because in the end, it's interests which decide the result of these negotiations. So I don't think Scotland would be asked to leave the European Union. Let me just finish by saying that it's not just if Scotland was outside the European Union. It's not just this complicated economic nightmare where firms and citizens in the European Union would lose their rights in Scotland. It's not very clever from the political point of view for the London government to say, stay out for 10 years. Why? Because Scotland in the European Union would be one of the closest allies of the rest of the United Kingdom in 95%, even 99%, the issues that are decided in Brussels. And if I was a British Prime Minister in the next few years, I would be wanting more allies in Europe and not less. So these are the reasons why I think that if the Scottish people say yes, there will be some very rapid adjustment of positions in London. A whole series of arguments are now being used to say X, Y, and Z can't be done by an independent Scotland. And I think on a number of these questions, including the way in which Scotland would join the European Union, the position of London would turn around 180% if there's a yes vote. Of course, in a period between Scotland's referendum and Scotland's independence, in matters for discussion in Brussels, it's London. It's the British government which would represent the United Kingdom. And this would be quite a severe test of the promise of the British government and the British Parliament to respect the result in Scotland, because it would manifestly be much simpler to handle Scotland's membership of the European Union if London represents more or less an agreed position with Edinburgh. If London and Edinburgh have divergent views on a number of the issues, then it could become quite complicated. But I wouldn't necessarily say that the others would agree with London rather than Edinburgh. I'm going to stop there.
Thank you. Thank you. So very thought-provoking talk. Now we'll conclude with more legal argument.
Have the microphone down.
Yeah, sure. And then we'll address our questions.
Thank you. Can you hear me up there? Yeah. Now, I'm going to start by saying something perhaps rather boring for those of you who might want entertainment this afternoon, which is that I completely agree with everything that Graham has just said, and I'm going to translate it into legal terms. And maybe I'm unusual as a lawyer in saying this, maybe I'm not. Having observed what my fellow lawyers have had to say, it has struck me that a lot of them, both from south of the border and from north of the border, seem to have been going out of their way to emphasise just how difficult independence would make Scottish membership of the EU. Now, there have been a couple of notable exceptions to that. One is Sir David Edward, who is the former British judge at the Court of Justice in Luxembourg. Another is Aidan O'Neill, a prominent QC. But for the most part, those that I've read or observed seem to be emphasising the difficulties and the need for a full accession process under Article 50, as Graham mentioned earlier, or Article 49, rather than under Article 48. So I also will have been struck in reading the debates at how adversarial, how agonistic the matter has become. And it's not just lawyers who like to present matters in adversarial terms. The Scottish government taking one somewhat entrenched view, the UK government, the view from London, looking somewhat different, stressing the difficulties of an independent Scotland's membership of the EU. But of course, there are actually three persons in this marriage, as a famous British royal once said, or perhaps we should say in this divorce, because that's what independence would be, and that's indeed what was the case in that situation too. And the third party is the European Union. And it's been a bit perplexing to me to wonder why the European Commission, but not just the European Commission, not just Barroso, but others, for example, Van Rompuy, have taken the view that they have about the difficulties of Scottish membership of the EU. And I think the problem with the position that they are taking is that this position of Barroso, that an independent Scotland would have to apply as a new member state, misrepresents what the EU is about, and I think it misrepresents EU law as well. What Barroso seems to me to be doing is using the language of international law, not taking into account the fact that for a long, long while, the EU has prided itself in being a new legal order of law, something a bit different, something that recognises both individual rights and individual obligations. It doesn't look like classic standard international law. And that was established a long, long while ago, in a very important case, Fagentenbos, part of the canon of EU law, really important case, 1963. And this is being ignored in the approach that says Scotland is simply going to be treated like any other new member state. So I find this a very disappointing approach that the Commission and Barroso are taking. I think it fails, firstly, because it fails to consider the example of a Europe of citizens and the European Court's jurisprudence to that effect. Namely, all of those people, all of those Scots, who currently have citizenship of the European Union because they are nationals of a member state. They won't automatically lose that citizenship on independence unless in a fit of pique some of them decide to tear up their UK passports. They will still be citizens of the European Union. Secondly, the Barroso approach, as I'll call it, fails to reconcile itself with the EU's values and norms, as we can see them in the spirit and the general scheme of the treaty. With the Lisbon Treaty, the EU very proudly declared for itself in Article 2 a whole statement of values, including democracy, the rule of law, human rights. It goes on. And if I have time, I'll come back to it. But I don't think the approach that says that on the date of independence, Scottish membership of the EU is suddenly cut off and it has to apply like Croatia or Turkey or any other country, I don't think that's reconcilable with this statement of values for reasons I'll come back to if I have time. Thirdly, this approach threatens to dislocate the single market unnecessarily, because the status of Scotland's role in the free movement of goods, services, persons and capital to and from Scotland and other EU member states would be at risk. And fourthly, in these statements from Barroso, but also Prodi earlier on in the decade, Van Rompuy, Viviana Reding, they're actually in conflict with earlier statements that were made by Commission officials back in the 1970s, when there were earlier considerations of possible Scottish independence. Emil Noelwyn considered that there would be two successor states, Scotland and our UK, which would both inherit membership and membership rights of the EU. Now, this is what I think is being missed out in the approach, which is coming both from London — it's horribly oversimplifying to describe this as London — but both from London and from the Commission in saying that there would have to be this formal application. I would argue that it's crucial to look at an EU of rights, values, and citizens more closely at a time when the EU is certainly being underrated and suffers a serious problem of popularity from its own citizens, and a great Eurosceptic approach that favours parties like UKIP. I think that rebuffing, alienating, emphasising the difficulties of admission of a country like Scotland that wants to maintain its EU membership will hardly do much for the EU's image. The EU ought to be shown what it can do for its citizens. And there are plenty of materials that can be drawn on in order for it to do just that, in order for the process of a putative, possible, Scottish independence to be smoother than the cynics and the naysayers are suggesting. There are, I think, three principal ways in which EU law can be used to bring this about. First, there is the obligation of good faith, which is to be found in the EU treaties, Article 4.3 to be precise. Sir David Edwards has stressed that the European Commission would be under a duty of good faith to negotiate with Scotland, with our UK, with other countries, to ensure that there were not an immediate hiatus or cessation of the rights of the people of Scotland, and not just those, but also the rights of other European nationals living in Scotland, working there, and the rights of Scots who are living in other EU countries. All of those have acquired rights under EU law. What are we suggesting? What is being suggested? That suddenly their rights would cease at the moment of independence? So Sir David Edwards has worked out, and in the evidence he has given to the Scottish Parliament, has discussed how this might work, and would give rise to a duty of negotiating under the treaty amendment process rather than the accession process. Secondly, there is an argument based on EU citizenship, a separate argument, but it's also one that relies on the distinct nature of the EU legal order and the prominent place that it gives to individuals as subjects of EU law. And it focuses on the central and crucial status citizenship of the EU. Now, one cannot be an EU citizen without first being a national of one of its member states. But the European Court has famously declared that European citizenship is destined to be the fundamental status of nationals of the member states. And it's actually shown itself willing to overlook the rule that matters of citizenship and nationality are internal matters for the member states only. From the relatively modest roots of EU citizenship in the EU treaties, the European Court has decided cases, such as Rotman and Zambrano, that set aside this internal rule and have curtailed the member states' freedom of action on matters of nationality. So one suggestion is that EU citizenship might also be relied on, the fact that individuals have acquired rights. These rights can't be ignored, and that can give rise to both a duty to negotiate, but also a more practical duty just to be able to work out this citizenship, to work out this situation. A common sense requirement to try to resolve the instability of having 5 million people who are EU citizens, but whose state could possibly have no status within the EU. So that's a second means of using EU law in the rather less positivistic way than it's been suggested by some lawyers, of using it in order to make a move of a newly independent Scotland smoother in terms of its EU membership. Thirdly, I think there are other arguments that can be used which relate to the very nature of the EU and certain general principles and fundamental rights that are protected in EU law. Sometimes we tend to overemphasize the economic nature of the EU. And although the single market is very important, we shouldn't remember the historical premise for its existence in the first place. The fact that it was brought into being to maintain peace and stability in the immediate post-war period. Again, what about peace and stability if the path for Scotland is not maintained into membership as a separate state? The statement of values in Article 2 of the European Union Treaty specifically stresses principles such as democracy, equality, rule of law, and respect for human rights. Isn't the referendum in Scotland itself an exercise of democracy? The EU prides itself in adhering to values such as democracy, augustly proclaimed in Article 2. It seeks to promote democracy in the near abroad, as well as globally. So there, I think, would be a problem of identity for the EU if it were to champion the cause of democracy in external matters, and then deprive those living in Scotland of their effective rights under EU law as a consequence of their exercising a democratic right to vote. I think it would be virtually impossible politically for the EU to square that circle and maintain its coherency as a champion of democracy. Finally, there are human rights arguments that I think work in favour of legal arguments against Scotland having to go through a whole formal accession process. Since 2000, the EU has had its own Charter of Fundamental Rights, made legally binding in 2009 by the Lisbon Treaty. Now, human rights treaties are always a bit special in international law because it's one area where there seems to be agreement that successor states, newly sovereign states, inherit the rights that they had under a previous regime. The European Court of Human Rights has stressed that in a case that was brought against Serbia and Montenegro, where it held that Montenegro inherited its obligations under the European Convention on Human Rights that had previously adhered to the joint fused country of Serbia, Montenegro. This is in keeping with the school of thought that human rights treaties will automatically bind successor states, represented by the UN Human Rights Committee's General Comment, number 26, on the continuity of obligations. Now, the EU treaties may not themselves be human rights treaties, but the Charter of Fundamental Rights has the same status as a treaty. So we can say that fundamental rights, human rights, are a very, very important element in EU law. And I think that at the very time when the UK Parliament is trying to pass legislation to disapply the Charter of Fundamental Rights in the United Kingdom, there's a certain dignity, if not an irony, in calling on fundamental rights as an added crown for Scotland's continuing membership of the EU. So that's all I plan to say about the legal case for making Scotland's transition, were it necessary, to independence in the EU smoother rather than harder. Graham did suggest that because I am a Scot, I was born in Edinburgh and I lived there until I was 18 and then came south to go to university, that I do have no right to vote in the referendum, but I might want to say something about more general reasons for independence. And of course that's such a broad topic, it would take us beyond, I think, the scope of this debate. But there is one related point I think I would raise, because as well as being an EU public lawyer, I teach constitutional law to students here as well. And one of the arguments that has been made for Scottish independence is that it would result in better governance because of the antiquated state of the British constitution. This argument is made in this book on Scottish independence. I don't know if any of you have come across it. I picked it up in Edinburgh when I was visiting my son who's at university there. And I highly recommend it. It states up very succinctly the for and against, yes and no. One of the points that is made in the yes case relates to the archaic nature of the British constitution and the fact that it is half steeped in feudalism, that it's not fit for purpose for the 21st century. The organisations, the institutions of the UK constitution, with the very, very puzzling role of the Crown, not to mention the status of the House of Lords that nobody seems to be able to do anything about. There are many reasons why one could be quite critical of the British Constitution. And in seeking independence, the Scots would have the ability to draft their own constitution, which might be more fit for 21st century purposes, and might also reflect a popular sovereignty stemming from the Scottish people. Rather than the idea that we are all subjects of Her Majesty and the Crown. And on that note, I'm going to stop.
Thank you. Thank you.